You're listening to Right On Radio on KFAI, that's 90.3 FM, and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview. On tonight's program, Josh Weber talks with Carla J. Hagen about her latest novel, Muskeg. In 1922, Hazel and Theta are young and in love, but that love is savagely interrupted by a police raid at a Savannah speakeasy. Hazel avoids prosecution by moving as far away from Theta as possible, eventually finding peace on a remote island on the Minnesota-Canadian border. When Theta suddenly appears 15 years later with her 12-year-old son, Hazel must make a potentially dangerous and life-changing choice.
And I'm Josh Weber.
Then in the last part of the hour...
This part of the hour, I show up and talk on Right On Radio. We'll feature one of our legacy interviews. Join us as we do a deep dive in the archives to play one of our favorite interviews from the past. All this and more. So stay tuned to Right On Radio. And here we are on Right On Radio. I'm here with Carla Hagen in studio. Carla has a reading for us she's going to do at the top of the hour. Carla, whenever you're ready.
Thanks, Josh. This is from the beginning of my book. Hazel and Theta, who Annie introduced, are in a speakeasy. And this is in Hazel's voice. She took another sip and glanced around to make sure people weren't looking at them. Hard to break old habits. But nobody was paying attention. So she took in the room. Clinking glasses, murmur of voices, notes from the piano and clarinet, smell of seafood and perfume. The soft chair she would have sunk into if she hadn't been so antsy. She realized that the dancers, the people sitting at the tables, everyone in the kitchen and the bar were women. Some dressed as men, with hair cropped or pulled back. Others in short dresses that clung to their bodies and left their legs free. Musicians were the only men, and pretty much everyone smoked. Between the steam from frying shrimp and the cigarette haze, you could barely see. At the next table, one woman sat on another woman's lap, arms wrapped around each other, kissing passionately. "See," Theta said, "we're not the only ones." But instead of relief, Hazel felt fear trickle down her spine. All her life she'd hidden who she was. Now, in this nightclub of women, she felt naked, like the things that kept her safe had flown away. The diner, the creek, Milt, the daily specials, all her brothers and sisters. She was just an odd girl, as the papers called them, and the only one who knew her was Theta. "Let's go somewhere else," she said. "This place makes me nervous." "We just got here." Theta placed her hand over Hazel's. "There are spots like this all over. New York, Paris, San Francisco." Hazel marveled at her young, shining face. "Yes, but we're in Savannah." "We could run away," Theta said. "Live together where no one knows us." "How about the diner and Milt?" Theta looked at her through thick lashes. "Milt's a swell guy. Maybe he'd let you get divorced." Hazel didn't even know anyone who was divorced. Rich people did it, or so she heard, but they lived in a different world. Besides, she didn't want to divorce Milt. He was her best friend, the only one in the world who understood all the parts of her. Why on earth would I do that? She had no desire to plunge into a world she didn't know. "I never been to those places. I never been anywhere but here." Couldn't they stay in Savannah? Couldn't Theta keep coming to the diner? Milt wasn't around that much, and she never asked him why, just as he never asked her what she did when he wasn't there. The H&M was a haven, and she loved it even more now that Theta was part of it. She'd never felt so warm and safe and loved. She didn't want to think of changing anything right now. She took Theta's hand. "Let's dance." They got to their feet, and Theta giggled. "All right, who's going to lead?" "You," Hazel said. "I'll follow." "I can't eat a thing," the piano player sang as the clarinet wove a melody over and under him. "Got those crazy blues." Hazel lay her head on Theta's shoulder, breathing in clean dress and warm skin. "Let's dance all night," she whispered. "Let's not sit down." Theta turned up Hazel's face and they kissed right in front of all those people who weren't watching anyway. 4, 5, 6, who knows how many songs they danced to, swaying together, Hazel's eyes closed, Theta's body pressed against hers. Notes vibrated through her to the ends of her fingers, the dance floor just big enough for the two of them. No, not the dance floor, the little bubble that held them, which she wanted to stay in forever. Sometime later, maybe hours, maybe less, Hazel heard a sound like the beat of the music, but louder, like a drum against the door. Go away, she thought. But the beat turned into pounding. It would not stop. She opened her eyes. Theta still held her, but the noise grew louder and louder, and then people started to scream, Raid! Raid! The door bent inward like rubber, although she was sure it was made of wood. Then a foot in a black boot kicked through it and hung there, like a magic trick in a theater. She laughed, but Theta hushed her. We've got to get out of here now. Hazel's belly turned to ice. How? Has to be a back way. Hazel grabbed her hand. I spotted one when we came in, beside the kitchen. They could barely move through the mass of women all trying to escape. Then the door with a boot crashed onto the dance floor in the place filled with policemen, ear-splitting whistles. Nobody leaves.
Very good. That was a wonderful reading from Muskeg by the author Carla Hagen. What we just heard right there was beginning of the end for young love that's gone awry when a police crackdown happens at a Savannah speakeasy. 15 years later, we find the heroine of our story, Hazel, running a fishing resort on a remote island near the Minnesota-Canadian border when her past catches up to her, when her former lover, Theta, arrives with her 12-year-old son. She also brings an angry husband and a posse of detectives fiercely tracking her. This is Carla's second novel, following Hand Me Down My Walking Cane, a winner of the 2012 Midwest Independent Publishers Award for Literary and Historical Fiction. Carla is a retired attorney who practiced law as a public defender, then as a prosecutor. When not writing, she swims, bikes, hikes, travels, studies languages, and co-hosts the weekly program Corazón Latino every Friday from 2 to 4 p.m. on KFAI. Carla Hagen, welcome to Write On Radio.
Thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here.
The title of the novel, as I just mentioned, is Muskeg. It wasn't a term I was familiar with before reading your book. What is a muskeg, and what is its significance to the story?
So muskeg is really an entity. It's the, as I put in the epigraph, it's comes from the Cree word and the Ojibwe words for peat. So the Cree muskeg and Ojibwe mushkig, meaning grassy bog. And it is a word that people in northern Minnesota use for peat bogs. In fact, when we talk about muskeg, we're talking about kind of the phenomenon of peat and also the bog and also what's in the bog. So it's kind of an embracing term. I didn't know that it meant peat. I didn't know what peat was. I grew up there in this border country, Lake of the Woods, right across from Rainy River. So very, very remote. We didn't have television until I was about 14, something like that.
It's very expansive, though, too. If I remember right what it says in the epigraph, it covers like 1.2 million kilometers, I think, of round Canada. Is that right? I don't know. It's a lot of space.
There's a lot of space.
Yeah, that muskeg covers.
Yes.
So you mentioned, so this background of the word muskeg is Cree.
Cree and Ojibwe.
Cree and Ojibwe. Yeah. And I just know in your bio how you have a background of studying languages. Can you talk about your interest in languages and where did that come from?
From the time I was a teeny, teeny little girl, I can remember I was always interested in the way people said things. And I would ask my mother, why does she say that word that way? And my mother would, I don't know what she said, but I remember sitting under the kitchen table as she would be with her sisters or friends or something like that, and they'd be talking. And I'd be sitting there not only to soak up the stories, which I loved, but I'd be just taking note of the way people said things, which I thought was very interesting. And, for example, like my aunts always talked about if they'd gone out somewhere, there was a tavern, a dance hall, a honky-tonk basically, called the Green Lantern. And they said, well, we were out to the Blue Lantern, or we was out to the Blue Lantern, or the Green Lantern, whatever it was, the other day. And Anyway, so I always found that interesting, and I wanted to learn other languages. I was just intrigued. My paternal grandma came from Norway. Never met my grandpa. He died before I was born, but she helped raise me. So I was hearing Norwegian constantly, and although I wasn't that interested, I was interested in French and made my mother buy me books in French to try to teach myself, and she'd take me across the river to visit some of her French-Canadian friends just so I could practice. And so I've always just been intrigued. It's like a lens into another culture, and I love different sounds. I love the architecture of it. I love kind of everything about other languages.
Do you think languages... Sorry, this is a totally sidetracking for your book here, but my last question, I swear,
that's
we'll talk
okay.
about muskeg. Do you think languages changes your ideas of how you think about the world around you?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, I really do, because it is like a lens, and it's a portal, if you will, into another culture. And I think I remember being in Mexico once, after I'd left there, I'd come back. I lived there about 5 years. And I was visiting a little village in Chiapas with my then husband, who was an anthropologist, and where they speak one of the Mayan languages. It's called Tzeltal, and one of the like 30-some discrete Mayan languages. And I was learning some words, and I loved the way it made me form sounds. That's real sounds, like they're called wounded consonants. And I was just fascinated. I just thought, never heard of wounded consonants before, and I like the idea of it. And yeah, it just makes your mind... I'm studying Arabic now, which really kind of turns your mind around.
You just reminded me. So I just came back from a trip in Ghana, and so besides English being the main language, also it's tree.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, what you just talked about, which it was really hard for me, it's hard for me to nail, is the tree. It's almost like a ch sound. Like
tree. Yeah.
And so yeah, it definitely helped me be more acclimated to where I was at the time. This is the second book you've written, but it's also the second book in your planned Minnesota-Canadian border trilogy. Where does your interest for the Minnesota-Canadian border begin? You just mentioned growing up with your grandmother. It was nearby the Lake of the Woods area, is that?
Lake of the Woods County, near Lake of the Woods. And I grew up in this place that was impossibly remote for the United States. We had no radio except at night from the United States, only radio from Canada, largely from Winnipeg. When we finally got a radio channel, or rather a TV channel, so that we could actually have TV in the town, it was from Winnipeg. And I found all that really interesting even growing up. And it's a very beautiful place. It's so remote, it's so different from anywhere else, that it felt special even when I was growing up. We're incredibly isolated. Like the nearest town of any size was Bemidji, which was 100 miles south. Winnipeg was our biggest city. That was about 150. I think just growing up in a place like that, and I think it just seeps into your DNA, you know. It certainly did for me. The water, the trees, the way the air smells, the way muskeg smells when it's burning, which it does every fall. And so even though I've spent years in Mexico, I've traveled and lived lots of places, I speak other languages, but I always seem to come back to Lake of the Woods. Maybe down the road I write in my poetry, I veer more, but yeah, when I'm writing prose and I'm writing a novel, I just keep coming back to Lake of the Woods. It's like very fertile ground for me.
And besides the Lake of the Woods, is there any other connection between Muskeg and Hand Me Down My Walking King? Do they contain similar themes or the same characters between these works?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. In fact, Hand Me Down My Walking King is a fictionalized account of the forced relocation of people who were living in these teeny tiny towns in the bog, just little villages. But they, they didn't have cops, they didn't have ministers, they were kind of, they could bootleg all they wanted, which was a lot. It wasn't productive land. The federal government, Andrew Volstead, who also authored Prohibition, which was a disaster, of course, authored a bill called the Judicial Ditching Act its aim was, in Lake of the Woods County, to drain the bogs, which is impossible. You can't drain a bog. And so they dug some ditches that were largely, futile. But the people who lived in these villages were taxed. They had taxes to pay, and they couldn't. They were just subsistence farmers just in the Depression. And so the government altruistically moved them out of there onto better farms, but people really didn't want to go. So it was a real legend in my hometown. It was left a bitter taste years after. So that was the setting of the first book. And this bog, the bog setting, is that same bog. There are a few people left in this little place, and they figure heavily into the novel.
When's the last time you visited the Lakes of the Woods area?
August.
Okay. You still go back to it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, my family, my brothers and I, and my husband and sisters-in-law, own our family house, which is just up the road from Lake of the Woods. No, we're very tied to it.
Tied to the land.
Yeah.
Muskeg opens with the protagonist Hazel and her girlfriend Theta at a queer-friendly speakeasy in Savannah. You do something impressive with Muskeg. You contextualize the history of queerness in America 100 years ago while also normalizing gay relationships for a contemporary reading audience by having the story be set in the past. Was this something you thought about while you were writing the novel?
So I ended up thinking about it quite a bit. Hazel and Minnie, who's her partner when Theta arrives 15 years later, as you were describing in the intro, were secondary characters in the first book. They're the two mothers of Rose, who's one of the main protagonists in Hand Me Down My Walking Cane. And they were always a couple. They were always lesbians. But I didn't know their backstory, and I wrote this book to write their story and the story of little Roy, who's a selectively mute fiddler, got traumatized mute, basically. And so in doing that, I had to do a lot of research on what it was like for gay people back in the 20s. A lot of women would marry. Like, for example, Hazel was married to Milt, who was also gay. Mm-hmm. They were good friends. They were, you know, it was a really good arrangement. A lot of women would do that. And also, in my little town when I was growing up in the region, I would be aware of couples living together, like a couple guys or a couple women, usually older, you know, some of the so-called Norwegian bachelor farmers. And my mom, who was really ahead of her time, and she'd say, well, honey, they're probably homosexual. I mean, she didn't use the word gay back then. She said, that's just how it is. And I think that, you know, nobody was really out, per se, in my hometown, but it's a place that's so remote that people really have to get along. They have to get along to survive, right? And so there's a fair amount of tolerance. There are several openly gay couples in my hometown right now. And but I think back then it was just what they call in Spanish a secreto voces. It was a secret everybody knew. You know, everybody knew it, but it was just kind of part of the landscape.
Something that's peculiar with the way you wrote the story, and it's kind of just, actually it's kind of builds upon what you're talking about, is when the raid happens at the speakeasy, the press and the police, they don't acknowledge that the characters are homosexual. They just, and I think that maybe, and I think in one of the headlines in the press is that there was women dressing like men, but that's probably the extent of it. And then Theta's attorney refers to her and Hazel as having the disease, and the characters themselves only talk about themselves as just being different. I think Milt even says that just they're kind of people. And I thought that was interesting because it's like there isn't a cultural consciousness that enables them to shape their identity of being gay. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, to the extent I know, I wish sometimes I could have been a fly in the wall back then and just overhear everybody's conversation. But I think especially in places like maybe Savannah, where it's not like New York City, where you have a gay, maybe underground culture, one of the major cities, and of course up in the Canadian border, right? I don't know exactly how they refer to themselves, but many women were called odd girls, and there were probably some other words for them too. But yeah, I mean, the implication was that saying perversion or girls dressed like men, they were saying a lot with mm-hmm. that. Like that was how people were referred to.
Yeah,
I think one of my characters actually says the word dyke in here. Yeah, it's Theta's husband.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not a nice man.
I like to think that some of the events in this book would be part of a bygone era. However, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the Saturday shooting that happened at the nightclub in Colorado Springs called Club Q. There's obviously still hostility towards the LGBTQ community. But the one positive thing I had while reading Muskeg is it made me realize there is more protection, I guess, from law enforcement. There is more support from publications, from news outlets, and more support from the general public compared to what we have in 1922 for this community. I was wondering if you could, what your thoughts were on this.
Well, that's certainly true. And absolutely, if you were gay, lesbian, queer, you had to hide it because it wasn't socially acceptable unless you're in a very specific little enclave. But I think one of the differences that I see, and again, I didn't live back in the 20s. My mother was born in 23, and I read all and heard all the stories I could possibly hear. But you didn't have a certain segment of the Republican Party. I guess that's fair. You didn't have a political party or kind of a group of people who were demonizing gays and lesbians. It wasn't even something people really talked about that much.
Right.
They were after communists, reds, anarchists. You know, it was the time of the Palmer raids and of Jack Reed and the people living in Greenwich Village who were indeed anarchists and communists. And so they were more interested in that. I mean, now their new bugaboo is LGBTQ people, yeah. It's their flames that did not need to be fanned. It's horrible. It's a tragedy. Not that it's ever been easy for people who are gay, lesbian, or queer, believe me, or trans. But now it's like there's an open season on them. It seems from the Republicans.
Mr. Robert John Williams is an attorney at law. Works on behalf of Theta's family in relocating Hazel. As I mentioned in your bio, in a past life, you were once an attorney yourself. Is Mr. Williams a character of someone you knew in a legal field? I was kind of curious how that person formed in your mind.
So he is kind of a caricature of, I'd say, a good old boy attorney. You know, he knows a prosecutor. Of course, it's a small place, too. He knows a judge, and he doesn't really approve. He definitely doesn't approve of Hazel because she's both lesbian and working class, but he doesn't really approve of Theta either, and thinks that she's kind of a pervert, and so he'll do the deal. He kind of holds them at arm's length and lets them know he doesn't approve of them, doesn't like them at all, but tells them both they should be grateful.
Is that a personality you'd find often within the legal profession, someone like, or is it this is completely just a fiction?
I would not have found people like that in my part of the legal profession. I was first a public defender in Hennepin County, then a Hennepin County attorney. I will say, when I first began practicing, and I'm not going to name names here, although I think this guy is long dead, but I started practicing as a public defender in 1987. There was a judge on the bench. If any of my old public defender friends out there are listening, they will know who I'm talking about, who was really, really retrograde. I mean, there were some old school guys who had smoked cigars in chambers, and thank God that we now have... You know, but there was one who was really, really mean, and he was particularly mean to our clients who were sex workers, who were prostitutes. He would insult them from the bench. I mean, I and many people have had to stand up for our clients in a way we never thought we were going to have to, against the very judge. And he was actually, he was one of the few judges that was voted out at some point. But yeah, he was horrible. He was really horrible. I've seen a few people like him, but thank God a lot more women were coming on the bench, and he was the one that was sticks in my mind.
The structure of Muskeg is, it's nonlinear. It's broken up into different parts of Hazel's life that I think it works better at complementing her story by seeing the before and after intermingled, I think. Did you set out to write Muskeg this way, or is this something that changed over time?
It changed, actually. When I first set out to write it, I wrote her story in the 20s, and then I jumped ahead to the 30s. And one of my writing groups, I'm in a novel writing group, and she said, well, it's like you've taken two books and pressed them together. And I said, Bonnie, it's a terrible thing to say. Bonnie, if you're listening, you know I appreciate that. But it was. And so... I was up at Lake of the Woods with some of my other writer friends, some of my women in my writing group, And I went into the garage, and we all had our separate little spaces, and I just started mixing things up. And I did 1922, 1936, or 37 actually. And I realized that was the only way it was going to work until it finally all evened out until we're in 1937. But I realized otherwise it was like two books, and I didn't want two books. I wanted one book.
I want to ask you this really quickly. We're almost out of time here, but the time here. So the character Theta mentions her name is like Theta Bara, the vamp.
Yes,
a well-known silent film actress. Are silent films something? I'm a cinephile, so I was like, oh, this is really cool. This is really interesting. Are silent films something you're interested in, or was that something that just came up in your research while writing the book?
Well, I knew about the name Theta in my imagining her name was like Theodora, but she hated that name, so she was called Theta. Not particularly silent films, but I'm definitely into film, and I thought it was real, you know, it would make a lot of sense that that would be a nickname for her.
And my last question, Carla, your next novel is, as I believe tentatively is titled right now, Into the Storm.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little about what it is and when we expect to see that released?
Sometime next year, hopefully.
Okay.
I should say that Calumet Press, my publisher, is going to be reissuing Hand Me Down My Walking Cane early next year. And I have to finish writing the book. I realized that because I'd done some of the secondary characters, I had to go back to my original characters from Hand Me Down My Walking Cane and just kind of wrap them up. And so I'll be going back to particularly Rose and Emil, who are mentioned in here. There's some misses from them in here, but they're big stars in the first book. And he's a photojournalist, and she is a writer. And they're going to go to the Spanish Civil War, because that's what progressive writers and photographers did back in the 1930s.
This has been my time talking with Carla J. Hagen about her book, Muskeg. Carla, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Annie.
And now this.
Reed Farrell Coleman, welcome to Right on Radio. Go ahead.
Okay, Chapter 1, Monday Night. Some people swallow their grief. Some let it swallow them. I guess there's about 1,000 degrees in between those extremes. Maybe a million. Maybe a million million. Who the hell knows? Not me. I don't. I'm just about able to put one foot before the other to breathe again. But not always, not even most of the time. Annie, my wife, I mean my ex-wife, she let it swallow her whole, and when it spit her back up, she was someone else, something else, a hornet from a butterfly. If I was on the outside looking in and not the central target of her fury and sting, I might understand it. I might forgive it. I tell myself I would. But I'd have to forgive myself first. I might as well wish for Jesus to reveal himself in my side view mirror, or for John Jr. to come back to us. At the moment, my wishes were less ambitious ones. I wish for the 11:38 to Ronkonkoma to be on time. I should have wished for it to be early.
Very good. You've been listening to Reed Farrell Coleman reading from his new novel, Where It Hurts. He is the author of many series, including the Mo Prager series and the Gulliver Dowd series. He took over writing Robert B. Parker's Jesse Stone series. He is a poet and teaches at Hofstra University in New York and has won the Anthony, Audi, Barry, McCavity, and Seamus Awards, and has been nominated for the Gumshoe and Edgar Awards. Reed Farrell Coleman, welcome to Write on Radio.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the story and who Gus Murphy is.
The story. Well, since I always start with character, let me start with Gus.
Sure.
Gus is the kind of guy I think we'd all love for a neighbor. He's the kind of guy, when he's shoveling the snow out of his driveway, he shovels his neighbor's driveway, not because he thinks there's a reward for him in this life or the next, but because he was raised to think it was the right thing to do. He's a retired Suffolk County, New York policeman, a uniform policeman, who has everything he wants. He has a lovely wife, a good marriage, two almost grown children, a nice pension, a house that's paid for, and the rest of his life to enjoy all those things. And as most people who have the things they want, he thinks he understands how the world works, how the universe works. And although he's no longer a believer in God, he does believe that the universe is, there's reason in the universe. He believes all that stuff until the moment he doesn't. His son, John Jr., dies of a heart defect playing basketball and blows his whole worldview and his family apart. And we pick the story up 2 years later when Gus is working in a kind of seedy hotel by Long Island MacArthur Airport. He drives the courtesy van just because it gives him something to do, and he lives at the hotel as well. So that's where the story picks up.
Okay. And you said that you start with character, so I'm curious. That got me to thinking. I've talked to a lot of mystery writers over the years, and a lot of them outline their stories before they start, but some of them don't, and I'm curious which approach you take.
I've never outlined a thing in my life. The closest thing I ever do to outlining is making a grocery list.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm kind of that way, too. I don't really like to outline. I like to see where the story is going to take me. And yet a lot of mystery writers feel like we need to know who the bad guy is and what the final solution is before we can start on the process of bringing the reader through all the hoops to get to the end result.
Well, I've never been a plot driven. I think plot is important, don't get me wrong, but I've never been a plot driven writer, because I believe 2 weeks after you close a book, do you really remember what the plot was?
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, you remember who the protagonist was. That's who you're thinking about. And so for me, I mean, plot is important, but really it's all about character.
Yeah.
And for me, as I write, my belief is if I surprise me with what's coming, the reader will be surprised and entertained with what's coming.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's really a great way to look at it. The other thing that struck me a little bit was the fact that John Jr. dies of a heart defect, and I would have thought, at least many mystery writers would have decided, okay, let's have his son be killed by somebody in an unsolved murder. And you chose not to go that way. Talk about that.
Well, I'm going to go back to building a character again.
Okay.
When I build a character, there's actually a Minnesotan author named Jess Lowry, who I fought with. And Jess likes to say, when to know a character, you have to know what's in his or her refrigerator or his or her waste paper basket, or in his or her wallet or bag. For me, I use that idea, but I go deeper. I want to know what someone's flaw is, what their secret is, and what embarrasses them and what is the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And for Gus, what I imagine what's the worst thing that could happen to me, and the thought of one of my children dying before me, mm-hmm. is, you know, what would blow up my world, and that would blow up my world. Mm-hmm. And so I needed Gus for the purposes of this book to start with completely off balance. And so, see, a murder, as is discussed in the book, there are people to go see about a murder.
Yeah.
Right? Somebody mm-hmm. committed the act. So you can find out who, why, what, where, and when to a murder. But who do you see about a trick of fate? Who mm-hmm. do you see when it's a hidden heart defect? There's nobody to get answers to.
Right.
And so that's why I started there, as opposed to having his son be murdered.
Yeah, yeah. And you give him Father Bill as sort of his best friend, and as you mentioned, he has lost his faith, but he still retains this connection to faith through his friendship with Father Bill.
Yeah, they're kindred spirits in a way. And one of the things I like to do in series novels, because this is going to be a series, There are going to be at least four books in the series.
Okay.
Is I like having a moral center to the series that isn't the protagonist.
Mm.
And so in my Mo Prager series, the moral center of the series was a man named Israel Roth. In this series, I hope Father Bill will be that moral center. Now, it may not be the morals that everybody expects.
Right.
But he will be the moral center of the series.
Okay. And speaking of Mo Prager, and you did the Gulliver Dowd series, and you're writing the Robert P. Parker, Jesse Stone series. Talk a little bit about the process of creating a new series and creating new characters. I mean, does it sort of free you up to say, you know, I can now make this character anything I want, and I'm going to go in a different direction, or I like certain elements of this other character, so I'm gonna bring those along. I mean, do you start completely fresh? Do you sort of work with some of the things you've done in the past?
You know, I try not to. Now, an objective observer looking at the very superficial elements might look at Gus and Mo, for instance, and say they're very similar. Both. Guys about 35, 40 years old, both retired from the job, though in a different way, both only uniformed policemen, not detectives. Yes, in that way they're superficially alike, but actually they couldn't be less alike in who they are. And I also like to match, although I always start with character, I have to make sure the character is of a place. And these books will be set on in Suffolk County, Long Island. The Long Island that is nothing like the Gold Coast. It's nothing like East or West Egg. It's nothing like the Hamptons. It's the Long Island where most Long Islanders live.
Yeah.
And so Gus had to be of that area. So although I'm building the character, I build the character where he exists, his milieu, his environment in mind.
Yeah, that was one of the things that sort of surprised me. I'm not a native New Yorker. I've been to New York State, but I don't think I've ever been to Long Island. And you mentioned at one point, I think there are 130 school districts on Long Island. I mean, it's really a massive place, isn't it?
Well, what's funny is it's not as big as you think. You'd think 130 school districts, it should be gigantic.
Mm.
The fact is that, as I discuss in the book, that those school districts are a way to really have our form of de facto segregation.
Mm.
You know, rich communities have smaller school districts. There's more money gets spent on their students. It keeps white people in white areas. It keeps African Americans in African areas, African American areas, and it keeps Hispanics in Hispanic areas. and it's really manipulated to state that to keep the status quo.
Hmm. Well, let's listen, if we can, to another passage from the book.
Sure. Oops, now I got to find one.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. This is a little further down in the first chapter.
Okay.
And Gus, just to set it up a little, Gus is still at the train station waiting for some gentlemen to come in so he can drive them to the airport. So, okay. Aziza, the mocha-skinned Pakistani girl behind the counter, nodded at me, smiled a gap-toothed smile. She no longer asked what I wanted, small coffee, half and half, two sweet and lows. She made it up for me, put it on the counter. She no longer gave me the change when I paid. She dropped the change in the paper tip cup with the other careless pennies, quarters, dimes, and nickels. I liked Aziza because she expected nothing of me beyond our routine. We danced our nightly dance and then went back to being strangers. She didn't expect me to put the pain behind me or to bravely get on with my life. Khalid, the night manager, a fleshy man with shark eyes and a suspicious face, stared at me as he always did. It was as if he could smell the taint on me. He didn't like me in the shop, thought I might sully the place with my taint, or maybe that wasn't it at all.
Very good. That is Reed Farrell Coleman reading from his new novel, Where It Hurts. And one of the things I love about your writing is the language. You really take a great deal of care with that. I suppose being a poet, in addition to being a writer of mysteries, that's just sort of maybe second nature to you. But talk about the importance of language just to sort of distinguish your work from so much of what's out there.
Well, I'd like to say that I started as a poet and I was a poet for a while, but I don't really actively do it anymore.
Mm, okay.
So, you know, I always feel like a poser and a fraud. But it is what I studied in college, so I guess that's, you know, you can let me get a pass on that. Language, even before I wrote, I was always good at expressing myself. And language was always, I always loved playing with words. You know, W.H. Auden, there's this apocryphal story about W.H. Auden. A woman came to him and said, you know, my son, he could be a great writer. I'm sure of it. He has a great vocabulary. He studies very hard. And Auden allegedly said to her, but does he like playing with words? And so I've always loved playing with words. And I've always had a good vocabulary. And somehow, you know, I don't like thinking about it too much because it works. And always, when you ask people about how they do things, they're always afraid it'll go away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's always a concern. But I think you're right. I mean, if you really sort of enjoy it, you're not as likely to do things like repeating the same word within a paragraph unless you mean to emphasize that word. And I see so many writers who will use sort of the same word, and I'm not talking about words like the or and, I'm talking about words like taint, you know, what you just talked about, what
right.
You just read. And that was a word I could tell specifically you wanted to use that word twice to emphasize that aspect of Gus's character that is being perceived or that might be perceived.
And I also think that there are certain words that have real power in them just intrinsically, and I think the word taint by itself has a lot of power to it. I don't think we think about that much. I, you know, it's my job to think about that. But I think words like taint are powerful all by themselves. So, and to repeat it, it really does underline it, to repeat it.
Yeah.
And yes, I purposely repeated that word. And if you read my paragraphs, I try really hard not to repeat.
Yeah. Well, and that's why it stands out to me, because you do a great job of that, and then you see something like that, and you say, aha, this is a word that I have to pay attention to. And the other thing that I love about your books is that your characters are very three-dimensional. Even your minor characters are relatively three-dimensional. You've got characters like Kristen, who is, I'm sure, will have a bigger role in future books, and Annie, who has a not real large role necessarily in this book. I'm guessing we'll have another larger role maybe in future books, but they're all sort of fleshed out and three-dimensional.
Well, I'm known for saying there's no such thing as a minor character in my books. And I always use this example when I teach character. Going to work today, did you walk or drive by someone walking their dog? You know, yes, most people do. You know, you hardly notice it, but I'm sure you did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they are a minor character in your life, right?
Yeah.
But think of their perspective. You're a minor character in their life.
Yeah.
So that that person walking that dog, even though he or she took up 2 seconds of your life, right? So they're minor, but they have their whole lives. So I never treat anybody as a spear carrier in my books. No one comes on stage and says, "Hark, I hear the cannons roar," and walk up the stage. But if they did, I would think of them as having full internal lives and families. So it's a matter more of how I think of them, and I think that translates to the page.
Mm, yeah. And a lot of your characters in this book have given up, haven't they?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have given up, generally. So, yes, a lot of people have given up. And I make that mistake sometimes. Yeah. Gus has pretty much given up.
Mm-hmm.
Almost.
Yeah.
And it's you know, I think even when you've given up, there's given up and there's really given up.
Yeah, there's giving up and laying down to die, and then there's giving up and still going through the motions and sort of hoping that you won't have to stay given up forever, I suppose.
And I think there even Gus at his worst, there was always hope in him.
Yeah, yeah. And I really liked Slava, too, and I imagine he will be back in future books as well.
Well, the next book is already done. Mm. It's called What You Break. And Slava plays a very... Slava is playing very big role.
Yeah, he's great. I mean, you can sense that he's as deep and as conflicted and as pained as Gus is. And initially when we meet him, we don't see any of that. And as the book goes on, we see more and more of that.
Yeah, he's the perfect example of there's no such thing as a minor character, because I could have done that with almost any of the characters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but for the plot choices I made, it might have been Felix the desk man who fulfilled Slava's role, or a Smudge, or any of the other characters.
Yeah.
So that's the joy. Like, going back to an earlier question, one of the joys in creating the first book in a series is you get to pick and choose who populates the world that you're going to write about.
Yeah, right. And another thing that every mystery kind of has to do is, or every author of mysteries kind of has to do, is keep certain information from readers. You do it very well. Some authors, you can tell, are sort of just, they have to do something that seems very contrived to keep the information away. Talk about how you go about structuring the story to keep crucial information from readers without making it seem contrived. That's a really tough thing to do, of course, in a short time. We only have a couple of minutes, but that's the question.
Well, I have a very simple answer to it. It's one of the real benefits of not outlining.
Mm.
It is a real benefit for me not to outline, because I'm never really sure how I'm going to give the information out until I reach a point where, oh, it makes sense to give some information here. You know, when you outline, you have to sort of outline and let yourself know, okay, I have to reveal this by this page. I have to reveal in this chapter. That's not an issue for me. When I'm getting to the end of the book, I know, you know, I better have revealed X, Y, and Z, or it's cheating the reader, and I hate cheating the reader.
Yeah, right. We're pretty much out of time, so I think we're just going to leave it at that. It was really amazingly well written. I really enjoy it, and I'm looking forward to the next one. You're going to have that one sent to us when that one comes out, because I'd love to talk to you again about this. We're out of time. This is Steve McKellistrom speaking with Reed Farrell Coleman about his new novel, Where It Hurts. Reed Farrell Coleman, thanks for being on Right on Radio.
Thanks for having me.
And now this.
Listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Annie Harview. I'd like to thank our special guest tonight, Carla J. Hagen, and I'd like to thank Josh for picking a fun archival episode from literally when I was in college, as well as all of our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at KFAI.org/Right on Radio. You can also listen to our Right on Radio episodes on our podcast. Go wherever you find podcasts, your Spotify, iTunes, Google, whatever.